As I said, we are quite happy to have Professor Saskia Brandruhl with us today. She's a professor of the learning sciences, actually, so one of the few learning sciences professorships in the world at the Open University of the Netherlands at Heerlen. She is also a director of the Education and Training Institute of Stelsteg there. She received a quite impressive number of awards, but I will just emphasize one. She received an award, let's see if I find it again. I think it's more or less on the best PhD supervisor in a Dutch award for the best PhD supervisor. And I think this is the award that best fits to what we have today here, a webinar with PhD students and master students. So she has a lot of experience with teaching in masters and on the PhD level. And we agreed that she will also give a little bit of information on more content-wise her biography through cognitive science, educational psychology herself, to also introduce you to her perspective a bit on learning and instruction and the learning sciences. Saskia, we are very much looking forward to listen to you and also discuss with you about your highly interesting work. Maybe I should mention, for those of you who are not so deep into information problem solving, that Saskia Brandruhl is one of the mostly cited and also most famous researchers in that field. So her work, her theoretical work, but also her empirical work, has been published in the best journals that we have in our field. So we are very much looking forward to listen to you, Saskia.
Okay, yes, now I am, huh? Yes. Okay, yes, my name is Saskia, you all already know. First of all, a little bit more about me and where I'm working right now. As Frank said, I was responsible for our master's program at Stelsteg, but Stelsteg doesn't exist anymore. don't panic. we now have a new institute here at the Open University because two institutes, Stelsteg, but also LUC, is another institute doing research on educational science, were merged together, and we are now the Welton Institute. An institute doing educational research on learning, teaching, and technology. So what we did within Stelsteg, partly remains the same. And in that new institute, I'm a kind of an chair, and I'm now organizing all kinds of things, because when you are starting a new institute, there's a lot of work to do. So that's what I'm doing right now. But of course, I'm also have my PhD students and my master thesis students that I guide. Okay, a little bit back in time. I'm an educational researcher, but I started doing an. First of all, I went to the teacher training college. So I am actually I'm a teacher for primary education, but. By the time I came off school, I was 21, and I had something like, okay, what I'm going to do? And I said, okay, remove my mic a bit from my mouse. Better so? This way? Okay, so I'm a teacher, but I had something like, okay, I want to study more. So I went to the university, and I did educational sciences. And after I get my master thesis, I had the opportunity to become a PhD student, and I did my research at university in Nijmegen at the Radboud University, and I studied there doing research with children, primary education, people who are who have problems with reading comprehension, and how can you design instruction to foster reading comprehension, and especially how can you instruct those children to be more metacognitive, to use more metacognitive strategies. So, What I did was making intervention programs and design education to foster reading comprehension. And I also, because those students were also poor technical readers, I also used listening strategies. So you listen to tasks and then you try to comprehend, and what kind of strategies can you use to comprehend text, and it worked. So that was nice. After my PhD thesis, I also was associate professor at the University in Tilburg. But after a few years, I went to Heerlen, and at the Open University, my research is on information problem solving, but not only on information problem solving, also on structural design. And I worked together a lot with Jeroen van Merrienboer, doing research on the 4CID model for instructional design. So as you will see also in my talk, when it's about designing instruction, those kind of principles are coming back in how you design instruction. So for the last 10 years, I did research on information problem solving with different PhD students. And what I want to do today is go through kind of an overview of what we did in the last 10 years and different aspects of the information problem solving process. What we did, what we find, what kind of methods we used. So I want to do two things. First, go into, what is information problem solving, and how does the process of information problem solving look like? So kind of unravel the process. But afterwards, I want to go into, how do you design instruction to foster those kind of skills in students? So I have two parts. Maybe the first part is a bit longer than the second.
Sorry to interrupt, Saskia. I wanted just to ask you if you could nod a little bit at this cable or pull a little bit. There seems to be a technical problem with your microphone, so the sound quality is not optimal. So maybe you would try again. You speak a little bit and try different things, and we tell you when it's working. Sorry for interruption.
Okay, I will sit still and don't come on my microphone. So what I want to do is two parts. First, go into the process of information problem solving, and kind of unravel the process and go into the methods we used in our research to gain more insight in what is happening when people solve information problems. But afterwards, I will go into the instructional design part. So how do you design instruction to foster those kind of skills? Okay, when you go to the slides, then you see in the first slide, it's slide two, actually. When you go to the first slide, of actually the second slide, then you see, what is information problem solving? There's a lot of research done, not only by myself and my colleagues, but also in the States by Eisenberg and Berkowitz, but also by Coulthard and other people. And when you go into literature, you always see the same kind of skills. And that is that when you solve information problems, it's that you are able to define the information you need, identify sources, but also are able to select and judge the relevant sources and make a good selection, and knowing what kind of criteria to use when selecting. And when you find a lot of information, you have to make a selection, but also make sure that you organize the information so that you can find back your information, the information you found. And eventually, most of the time, especially in education, you have to you have an assignment. So maybe you have to make an essay or a thesis, or you have to make a presentation. So you have to transform the information and make it your own and make an make a product. And eventually what we, especially in education, say is that, we have to construct knowledge. So you use all kind of information you find, especially on the internet, and try to make it your own. So yeah, that is the process of information problem solving. What did we do when we go a slide further? Then we see that we have done different research projects in unraveling the process of information problem solving, because what we want to know is, okay, when people are solving those kind of problems, you have a problem, you go and sit behind the internet and you're going to search for information, what's happening then? What kind of thinking steps do people make, and how do they reason and proceed through the tasks? So we did a different study and we started in 2003.
Sorry to interrupt again. I'm really not trying to bug you, Saskia, but it's hard to follow if we don't hear you in the right way. I think that was something in between. So your microphone, there is something wrong with that. First it was too close, then we had this kind of whistling of the air. And then it was too far away. If it's too far away, your voice is very, very thin and we can hardly hear you. So it's something in between. So maybe you can just test before going on and we give a sign with the smileys or when it works. Okay, sorry for that.
No, okay, it's not a problem. Okay, when I talk this way, how does it seems to work? Is this okay? Yes, smiley, smiley. Yes, okay. Then I leave it this way then, and I can go on. Okay, and when something happens, then let me know. Okay, and I'll try to speak in one tone. Okay, we did different research projects on unraveling the IPS process. So what is happening when students especially are searching for the internet for information, and what kind of process do they go through? So we did different studies. We started in 2003, publication in 2003. It was in Dutch, but afterwards we went on and study also most cited now is a study I did with Ivan Wolpereit and Yvonne Vermette. And what I will do is go a little bit into that study and see, okay, what did we did in the study, what were the research questions, how was the setup, what were the results, and afterwards I have something like, because what I'm going to do is address a number of projects, and after each research project, if there are questions or suggestions, I think we can discuss. Okay, the study I want to address is the study that I did with Ivan Wolpereit and Yvonne Vermette. Is published in 2005 in Computers and Human Behavior. And what we did in that study is we had five experts in information problem solving. Those were PhD students, because I think, okay, when you are a PhD student, you should be able to search for information. And we had five novices, and those five novices were students from the University of Maastricht, and those were first year students, so freshmen. And with the idea, okay, they just started the study and probably are not that good in solving all kind of information problems. What did we do with those people? We gave them a task and said to them, okay, you have 90 minutes to search for information, because you were asked to write an essay for a consumer magazine, and it should be about food that is out of date. Should we eat food that is out of date, or should we put it in the garbage? In the garbage. How do you call such a thing? Garbage. So the question is, okay, you have to write an essay and you have to search on the internet. You have 1.5 hours and you have to write the essay. But meanwhile, you have to think aloud. So those people were thinking aloud for 1.5 hours. It's very long, but okay, they did it and it went well. And they were able to search the internet, and they had a Word file to cut and paste all kind of information, and worked on the tasks. afterwards, all the protocols were typed out and analyzed. And what we did was making a coding scheme, and based on this, so we said, okay, we have a coding scheme and we have main skills, and the main skills were the skills defining the problem. Because before you start, you have to know, okay, what I'm searching for, what is my question. Then there's a phase in that you will really search for information. So you go, probably to Google, and search for information, typing keywords, all those kind of things. You select information and you scan information. And when you had the idea, okay, this is information I can use, then you study it more in depth. So that is also a phase in which you say, okay, I'm going to read the information, and eventually you have to come up with a product. So those are the five main skills we used to score. And all those main skills, we defined sub-skills. And eventually we also scored all kind of regulation activities, because people are also saying things like, I can't find it, or maybe I should use different keywords, or all kind of regulation activities, like, oh, I have to hurry because I don't have much time anymore, or it's going all right. So all kind of statements in which they step back from what they are doing and looking from a distance to their own process. So those regulation activities were also scored. That was a hell of a job, because the protocols were 1.5 hours, so sometimes we had protocols of more than 50 pages. So, yeah, that was nice to do. And in the next slide, slide 6, it's a graphic. And what you see there is the results of what we found. At the top, you see the five main skills. Defining the problem, search for information, scan the information. You have to process it and you have to organize and present it. And also the sub-skills are in the graphic, because retask, you have to make your problem more concrete. You have to activate your prior knowledge and clarify task requirements. And for instance, when you search information, you have to come up with keywords, search terms. And you have also to judge your search results, your SERP. So all those kind of SERP processes are also in the picture. And at the top, you see the monitoring and regulation activities. And what we did was, okay, when you have protocols, you can count how often people do those kind of skills and process those kind of things. And what you can also do is see how many, not only how many times, but also how long. How long do people actually are defining their problem or searching? And the yellow pictures on the slide are where we found difference between the expert and the novices. And what we see here is that we saw that those experts were far often regulating their process. So the experts are far more regulating their process and taking steps back and saying things like, okay, where am I going? How many time do I have? I think it's the right way or the wrong way. And when it's not going well, what to do, and steer their process. So that's really an characteristic of an expert, regulating the process. Because what we also saw, I have one protocol, is very nice, because you see the girl who is searching is really frustrating and saying, and I can't find anything, but she didn't steer her process, and she's getting much more frustrated. So she did not regulate that well, so that's not good. What we also found was that the experts took more time to define the problem, and that's very important, because when you don't think hard enough about what is my problem, what are my search questions, and what do I really need for kind of information, what do I already know about it, and you just start searching, then you get lost because you have no direction. So more goal-directed searching, it's better to define your problem on beforehand. So, and that's what we saw. The experts really did it more often, but also took more time to do that.
Maybe a good point to interrupt you. Sorry for that. LMU has a question, or they want to say what our video technician and audio technician recommended. So we still, Saskia, we still have little explosions from the air coming from your mouth. So it's too close to your mouth now. And if he recommends to put the microphone under your mouth and not in front of your mouth. So maybe you keep the distance, but put it under your mouth, and we try again. So there's still, it's hard to follow with these little explosions in between. Sorry.
Okay. Let's see if this is working. Otherwise, I have to maybe get another headset. That's also an idea, but okay. Okay, let's see if this is working. Looking to the expert and the novices, we did find some difference in the process, and that is that the experts are more regulating, but also defining the problem more often, put more effort and time in really processing information. We did find differences, and most important, they also judge more often. So go more into, okay, what kind of information do I have here? Is it important? Is it trustable? So that is what we saw with the expert. So this study was the basis of the rest of the work we did in the years afterwards, because those five processes, knowing what the differences are between novices and experts, that was a good start of our research, because knowing where the differences are, then you also know where you put your effort in when designing instructions, for instance. So what we found interesting is, okay, we see differences in experts and novice on judging information, and one of the things we did afterwards in a study with Amber Walrave and Els Boshuizen was going more in depth in how do people select the information, what kind of criteria do people use when selecting. Because we had the idea, especially with children in secondary education, they click on the first link in internet and just cut and paste and ready. So we had the idea, we want to know more about, okay, how do people evaluate information? And that is what we did in the study with Amber Walrave. This was published in 2009 in Computers and Education. Amber was also a PhD student and did different studies on this topic. But I want to say something more about what we found about unraveling the process, what kind of processes are involved, and what we see, what we did is we had students from secondary education this time, and say, okay, we had 23 students, and we gave them different kind of tasks in which they had to search for information, and again, we let them think aloud. And they think aloud for 30 minutes per task, and they got two tasks. And what we did was all kind of different tasks. So we made a mixture and randomly assigned students to those kind of tasks. And for instance, one of the tasks, and you can see it on slide 8, is about, okay, young people use by that time MSN or SMS text things, and the question is, does it have an influence on their language proficiency? Because when you text, you use other kind of language than when you speak. So they had to search for information, and that was not always because sometimes there are different ideas about what the impact is. So you have to make a decision on what is important to select. What we did, again, we recorded all the protocols and we analyzed it, and results were, yeah, I can say shocking, because what we saw was students do hardly evaluate, and if they evaluate, it is especially superficial kind of evaluation and saying, okay, yes, I think it is important, or yeah, I can use this, or seems nice. So yeah, and they hardly use criteria and saying something about yeah, how reliable the information is, how trustworthy it is. So most of the time they say, okay, I can use it because it's an answer on the question, but they don't say anything about this is information by a research institute, or it is from an author I know and it's an important author, or say something about the organization decide. For instance, when people search information on healthy foods and go to a website of McDonald's, yeah, the question is how reliable is that? So when people don't ask themselves questions about the reliability or the trustworthiness, yeah, that's not okay. But that is what we found. Students do hardly judge the information. I think what we by then, because it was in yeah, 2007 or 8 that we did that research, so it's also yeah, 8 years ago, something like that. And also our research methods became more sophisticated, and we had something like, okay, but when you let them think aloud, because what we saw in our protocols was that students clicked on website, on links, and there were, yeah, most of the time, not most of the time, but maybe for, they clicked a lot, not saying anything. So, yeah, but when you click on a link or click it away, then you, yeah, why do you click it away? So we had a lot of clicks without any reasoning behind why students clicked on certain information. So we had the idea of, yeah, maybe they judge, but don't say anything about it. So what we did in next studies was using an eye tracker and see, okay, when you use an eye tracker, you can yeah, log the clicks, but you can also see where people are looking, and you get yeah, more information about the process. And what we also did was using Qt retrospective reports, because when you use Qt retrospective reports, then what you do is you gave students their eye movements, so they are looking to their own eye movements, and what we did is half speed, so they look at their own eye movements on half speed, and then we said to them, okay, when you went through through the process, please tell us what your thoughts were during task completion. So the cues were their own eye movements, and that is what we also did in the next study. The study, the manuscript is still in progress. I'm too busy. This it's a study I did with Ludo van Meeuwen, Tamara van Gogh, and also Yvonne Kammerer was involved, because she did a part of the eye movement analysis. And what we did was, okay, we had 20 students, psychology students, but also 70 psychology teachers, because we not only used eye tracking and the Qt retrospective report method to analyze the process, but we also want to know, okay, if there are difference in searching when people are expert in a certain domain or a novice in a certain domain. So we had also two questions. And what we did was, again, give those participants a task, and There were really two tasks, one about the reliability of human memory and one about altruism. And they get a Google like search page, and they had to select information and yeah, also rank the information. So the best five sites, what are the best five sites you were you want to use to do the assignment. And on slide 12 you see a picture of the eye movements, and what you do is, okay, you see the eye movements of the of a student, and when so you see the fixations and the cascades, and when people see their own eye movements back, they can also say something about, okay, where were you looking at, and what were your ideas and your thoughts. And what we saw there was that when you compare eye movements with thinking aloud, then you see people do not judge using other criteria, but they judge more. So they say more about how they judged, but they don't use other criteria when they think aloud. So that was a nice result. And another result concerning, okay, what is the impact of prior knowledge on information problem solving? We saw that the domain experts evaluate the reliability of the sites, yeah, more than the novices. So, yeah, they have a better idea about, okay, when it is about the reliability of human memory, because they were psychology teachers, so okay, they know the most important authors on that field, so they were able to say, okay, this is nice information because it's from Professor Wagenaar, for instance, or they say, okay, this is nice because it's from the University of Maastricht, and there I know there are experts there, so they were able to judge those websites in a better way. So there is a difference between expert and novices in the domain. And what we also saw was that the novices use more superficial criteria, like, yeah, it's nice, or I think I can use this. So not saying anything about the criteria used for evaluating, but more superficial. And eventually what we did was looking at, okay, when you are an expert and you also were able to judge the sites in a better way and more, does it have a relation with the quality of the sites they select, because they make the rank of the most important websites to use. And what we saw was that the experts, yeah, there was a relation. So how better you are in evaluating, the better quality of the websites you select. So that was really nice, because what I hear often at conferences is that people say, yeah, of course it's important to evaluate, but yeah, is it always important? Because do you see differences in the assignment of students who really are selecting and using criteria in their selections or not? And this is this is saying yes, it does matter. When you are better in evaluating the sources, you also come up with better information. So that's nice. Okay, I'm looking at the time. A last part about a study which we recently did on unraveling the process and what is happening there is because there is a lot of research also doing in by von Kammerer in Tübingen, but also in Norway by the group of Eva Braten, doing research about all kind of personal characteristics that are important when searching, but also what do people do with conflicting information, because there's a lot of information on the internet, and there are lot of topics when you are searching then you find conflicting information. So what are you doing with that kind of information? And what we did was especially go into Okay, how do you deal with this conflicting information, and what is the effect of your attitude? So when you are searching, for instance, on the effects of climate change, and you believe that it is us humans who are responsible for those warm summers, what does your attitude what impact does your attitude have on how you deal with those conflicting information? The article of Johan van Strien, he is a PhD student of Els Boshuizen and myself, was just recently accepted for in computer and human behavior. And what Johan did was, we had 63 students, and they were from secondary education, and we gave them some reading materials on climate change. Oh, not on climate change, it's not a study. It was on video games. And when you play violent video games, do you become also more violent? So what is the impact of those kind of video games on young children? So what we did was give them text to read, text in favor of the topic, and six against the topic, also one neutral text, a more introductory text. And what we asked them to do is, okay, you have to write an essay on the relationship between those violent video games and aggressive behavior. And on beforehand, we asked them their attitude about the topic. So are you neutral and saying, I don't know if there is an impact, or are you positive and saying, yeah, when you play a lot of those games, you will be much more aggressive? Or do you say, no impact, because you play those games together with your friends, you become more social? It's also an idea. So we asked people about their attitudes on beforehand. And then we analyzed essays and see, okay, when you see the essays, what do you see? Do you see that they have a neutral or a positive or a negative idea? And sometimes you can also say it's strongly biased or slightly. And what we then did is say, okay, they have read text and they write the essay. How many information did they borrow from the text? So just cut and paste the information, or did they add information by themselves, so new ideas, or did they transform the information and saying, okay, did they make inferences using the text, or make conclusions over text? So we analyzed those essays. And what we found was that participants who had a strong prior attitude, saying, yes, it is there is an influence on violent video games. Those kind of students were more likely to write essays that were strongly biased, and also lean to that side of the debate. So it's also called information bias, because that you go into the you write your essay and you search for information that that is in line with your prior attitudes. So that's nice to know, because in education, when we let students search for all kind of information, it's important to know what their own idea is, because their own idea about a topic will have an impact on what kind of information you select. And do you want people to write a neutral kind of essay, or do you want them to choose a side? So it's important also for education to be aware of what is happening there. So prior attitude is important to take into account. That's important. Okay, what I want to do, because I'm talking too long, far too long. What I want to know about, what are your ideas about, because what we did in our research till now was using different kind of methodologies. We used thinking aloud protocols, and in which people have to think aloud during task performance. So we also used eye movements to see, okay, where are people looking at during task performance. But we also used cute retrospective reports in which we say you have a cue and afterwards you tell us what your thoughts are. Yeah, you also can use questionnaires. We did it once, but that's not the most good idea. But you can also use logging data in which you say I can see what kind of clicks people do. And what I like to know from you people is, what do you think about those research methods? What are the advantages and disadvantages of those methods? What we can do is that we take 5 minutes, that you can reflect on it by yourself and then come back and see what you come up with and see what kind of research methods you prefer for those kind of measuring those kind of processes. Is that okay? Or do you already have ideas about it? Annelies, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you for your nice presentation. I know your research because studies is based on your research, your model, and I really like the methods you describe, the thinking aloud, the eye tracking. But in our research, we mostly do research in classroom settings, and then it's very difficult to use these kind of methods. But I think these methods are really useful and the best option to unravel the process. And it's nice that we can base our research on your research that really describe in detail the steps that the thinking process of students. But for us, we do most of our research is in classroom settings with large scale with a lot of students, and then it's really difficult to we have. Not a lot of time to measure this process, which is a limitation of for our study, I know. But yeah, that is my reaction. Thank you.
Sorry to just squeeze in between. As I know, we have also groups participating. Typically, these groups need a bit of time to come up with a discussion and a suggestion themselves. And I want to ask Saskia also, I want to ask recent students and LMU students if they need some time. And then I think we should also give them a couple of minutes to discuss without discussing publicly. And then we will share the thoughts. So LMU is asking for 5 minutes. Should we? Okay, my suggestion would be give them 5 minutes. Also the individuals, Maria and Annelies, you thanks Annelies for this contribution. Maybe you can also come back into the discussion afterwards.
Okay, that's a fine idea. Let's say 5 minutes. It's now a little bit 4:02. Let's say about 5 minutes after. Two. It's our time. Yeah, I think we all have the same time. Huh? So yeah, okay. And Annelies, yes, I know your work, so that's fine. We'll go into it.
Okay, are the groups done? I think the individuals are quicker. But is that okay? Participating groups, if we continue.
Okay, are we all ready then? Also the group? Can you show me a smiley or something like that? No reaction. Still discussing, but we can go on. Okay. Okay, then we go on. Maybe who wants to react? Yeah, the first one.
Problems.
Will you begin?
Yeah. Hello. We were having here a big discussion about like two parts, and one part was about most of the people present here are like for the methods. I'm pretty much I'm the only one that is not against, but I can see several problems. By my experience, I know, for instance, that thinking aloud protocols are really problematic in the sense that they can interrupt people, the people process, in order for them to externalize that they are thinking, or and vice versa. So, of course, so far I don't know any method that is like better than that in order to evaluate problem solving. That is like the most classic from Newell and Simon perspective. That's thinking aloud protocols. And well, I actually cannot come up with something better, but it's just that I was pointing out like all the deficits. But Mariam, instead, she pointed out very, very good things on how to overcome those deficits. So it was, I think, a very productive discussion. And maybe Mariam also can share a little bit of what we discussed.
We're actually talking about like some of the possibilities. And like the best way is like to always like end with like different methods of research is to always like use triangulation. So for example, like using the eye tracking along with the think aloud protocols can help in like reducing the bias in these methods.
I would be interested in your methods with letting the students look at their own eye tracking. How much time passed between their actual search and their looking at the eye tracking? Because I would think that this should be, well, quite near to each other, because otherwise they forget what they were searching. I'm not hearing anything. I hope the others can hear. I'm stopping now.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Fisher? Yeah, okay.
Okay, Maria, can you hear us again? Maybe a smiley? Okay, we can hear you, Maria. Okay, a little bit of a reaction of... thinking aloud. The problem with thinking aloud is that thinking aloud is also demanding, and it interferes with your own process. And it maybe also slow down your process. And what is also is that you don't give all your thoughts. So that is what we also saw when people were evaluating the information, because we see on the log files and you see on screen that they click on all kind of information but don't say anything. So yeah, something is happening there because you click information away. So why did you do that? So we had the idea, okay, thinking aloud is okay, but are there other options? And that's what we did with cute retrospective reports, so that you can say you look back to your eye movements, and then you, and if you do it on half speed, you have more time to talk about what your thoughts were. A pitfall is that in meanwhile you don't know exactly if this was really what they were thinking of, that because there is the possibility that they also can make up new information and new ideas about what they did when evaluating. But okay, that's what you take into account. What is also is that when you use eye tracking, you can only give students tasks of from about 10 minutes, because when it is longer than 10 minutes, you simply do not remember your thoughts anymore, because then it's too much. So when we use cute retrospective reports, we say, okay, there's a task, search for 10 minutes, and directly afterwards you say to students, okay, this were your eye movements, and now what were your thoughts? So no time in between, and only for 10 minutes, because when it is longer, people are going to say, yeah, I really don't remember what I did here. So small tasks when you use cute retrospective reports. Then the issue of triangulation, that is Yeah, what we did, I did not mention it yet, together with Esther Argelagos from the University of Lleida in Spain, we did a study in which we used different methods, in which we logged students' computer clicks, and we also used eye movements, and we used cute retrospective reports. We did not use thinking aloud, because in the study I mentioned with what we did with Yvonne Kammerer from Tübingen and Ludo van Meeuwen and Tamara van Gogh. We compared the thinking aloud with the cute retrospective report. Because when you compare, when you do research and use the eye movements and also cute retrospective reports and logging files, you get a more whole picture of what is happening. Because what we saw is when you use thinking aloud or cute retrospective report, it's the only way to say something about regulation. How do people regulate their process? Because when you have log files or eye movements, you see where they were looking at, but you don't know their source, so you don't know if they were regulating or not. So you have to do something like thinking aloud or cute to say something about regulation activities of students. You get different kind of information from those different methods. Somebody else, reactions. Maria.
Hi. I personally believe in the power of combining think aloud protocols with eye movement, eye tracking data. And I also recognize the defaults of both methods if they are not combined. But since they have strong benefits, like their spontaneity and their authenticity in providing a rich information and from what people are thinking at the moment they are doing what they're doing, clicking on the links or thinking about their next steps, I'm quite on this side of the methods. What I was thinking right now when listening to Ms. Bowell talking about this was, did you notice any important self-regulation patterns of the experts in their thinking aloud protocols about their next steps, maybe some speculation, some justification, some inferences, or some relations when defining their problems? You mentioned it took them quite long to do it. Was it because they were thinking like silently and you don't know what happened, or did you manage to notice anything important happening?
What we saw with the experts compared to the novice in the study of 2005 concerning how they define the problem is that the experts, let me see the picture. What the experts really did more than the novices was going into, okay, what do I already know about the topic, and far more elaborate on, okay, this is what I already know, what are my questions, and what kind of information do I need to search for to come up with a product, because they had to write an essay. So they went more in depth about, okay, what are the other questions, where do I want to look for, because the for instance, it was about food that was out of date, and the farmer go into, okay, what do I want to know? I want to know what the law is saying about the date best before on what we found on our food, and or they want to say, okay, are there differences between different kind of food? Because when you have vegetables, it's another story than when you have all kind of other products like spaghetti or pasta. So they went more in depth about, okay, what do I really need and what can I, where can I search for? So yeah, they're far more goal driven. And the novices were more like, okay, I need to know something about food and the date on food and just start searching. So it's more, okay, then they get some information, say, oh yeah, this may be also important. So it's more data driven than goal driven. So that was the difference between the experts and the novices concerning the process of defining the problem. Is that a bit of an answer on your question, Maria?
Yeah, I think so. I just wonder if they were making any relations to their next steps, if they were kind of also guessing what their next steps should be, and if you were able to retrieve those data from their thinking aloud protocols. Because you already mentioned that they were better in this procedure. That's why I was thinking in which sense they were better, but you explained it. Thank you.
Hi, I got a question, because you say that the experts, they're more looking for what I already know. So basically, that means, did you find out if they're more biased by the prior knowledge, as you said before in the first study?
Yeah, but in the beginning, because there were expert and novices not in the domain, but on information problem solving, because the expert were the PhD students and the novices were the first year students of psychology. And what we did is go into, because it was about food that is out of date, and we controlled for the prior knowledge. So they had the same kind of prior knowledge. But the expert in searching an information problem, yeah, probably know that they have to be more goal-driven and go into their to their problem. Although, doesn't have, the domain knowledge was the same, so that was not an issue. Is that an answer?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that was an answer. Thank you.
Okay, maybe I can say something because Annelies was in the chat saying, okay, this is nice for doing research and probably most of the research concerning unraveling those processes are done in a laboratory setting. But what's when you are doing research in classrooms? Because then it is a little bit problematic to use eye tracking when you have a classroom full of children. And she asked, okay, how do you measure then what people do? We did different research in which we designed instruction and also measured the results of our instruction. And what we did there was, for instance, the studies of Amber Walraff, what she did was pen and paper, paper and pencil. How do you say paper and pencil test, in which we made prints of Google pages and asked people, okay, when this is the assignment you have, this is the websites you find in your results page, Google results page, which links would you click on, and tell us why you choose certain links to click on. So we get an idea about how people evaluate and select information. So yeah, it's not most ideal, but when you have group, you have to do something. And eventually we found differences, because the students in the experimental setting were better able to write down on the paper their criteria of why they select certain websites. So yeah, that is what we, for instance, did. Okay, Annelies said she did the same in her recent study. What we do now in a research study I do with another PhD student, Jimmy, and he is going to start his research next week. And what we do there is people are searching for information on the internet, and they will give them 20 minutes, and every time after 5 minutes we say you have to stop and fill out a process worksheet, and we have to say, okay, what are you doing, how is it going, what is going wrong, what is going well, and how do you proceed, but also ask about their mental effort. So we say to them, okay, you have to stop in a certain minute, and then we say fill in the process worksheet and give us some information about your process. So that's another thing we want to try to see, okay, what kind of information do we get from this kind of measurement.
Hi, I have a question, and it's about, well, it's a little bit difficult to formulate this question, but don't you think that the technologies used for research shape also the way people research and what they are looking for at the time that they shape, like how they are looking for? Because I, for instance, I remember that when I was a child, like Google didn't exist and pretty much the internet didn't exist. And when you need to look for something, you really need to go like to this library and look through these keywords lists and look for specific journals and, well, everything. And so you learn to do that, like very categorize things and look in a very specific way, very systematically, I will say. But now, as you say, like the new generations, the generations that have been shaped by Google, they just go and type whatever, like a long phrase. They don't even need to use keywords. They just need, how can I do this? And just put it on Google, and Google, they just click in the first link that appears. So how can you know that, for instance, the experts are not shaped by that old school of research or looking for information, while this new, what you are looking there is also a new way of researching with this new generation?
Yeah, that's a nice question, because having the internet now make that we have a lot of information we can go through. But on the other hand, when you the process you describe, when we didn't have the internet, we had to go to the library. You know, you have to know how to search the thesaurus and come up with keywords and go into do all kind of database. But eventually, there's a kind of a process you have to go through to find your information, and it is the same when you use the internet, because eventually when you don't know how you can search or what kind of search strategies you can use, especially when you're searching for scientific publications, you have to know what kind of databases do I have, what kind of search strategies can I use. Forward searching is possible with Google Scholar, for instance. Backward searching, also known as snowball searching. Keyword search and how you can refine your keywords. So there are all kind of strategies and all kind of knowing how to handle and what procedures you can use to make sure that your process is going in the right direction. So sometimes it's also hard to say, okay, what kind of research are you doing? Yeah, I'm looking how people search the internet, and sometimes people are laughing because, yeah, what kind of research is it? Because it's so easy, everybody does it every day. But when you're searching for, not when you're searching for how late does my train leave from München station, but when you're searching information for an essay or a thesis, it's more demanding. So then you have to know about what kind of strategies can you use to make it systematic, and that is what we try to stimulate in children and in students to make sure that the process is systematic and that you at a certain point know, okay, these are the keywords I use. And because what we saw in a lot of protocols is that people they use certain keywords, go on and go on and go on, and then I see the same keywords again. It's not systematic. So there's a kind of heuristic process, and when people know what the process is and how you can proceed, then you will be more successful. So I think, although we didn't have the internet in the past, I think the procedures of how to search remains the same. Is that a bit of an answer?
Yeah, it's perfect. So you're looking like for a structural thing, based more like in the systematicity of the search more than, yeah, the way it's used. But so it's perfect.
Okay, are there other issues? Because I had the idea, we see how far we can get. The part about instructional design is another part. Maybe we can do another webinar again someday and go more into the instructional part, because there's lots about to say about how to design instruction and use things like because for instance the 4CID model of Jeroen van Merriebo is going into how do you learn complex cognitive processes, and I think information problem solving is a complex cognitive process, and how do you design instruction and use authentic tasks embedded in the curricula, use process worksheets or use emphasis manipulation and so on. So we can say a lot about it, but okay, I got a deal with Frank, I see, for another webinar. Okay, are there other issues that we want to raise for today? Yes?
I would have a question concerning your introductory article to the Computers and Human Behavior special issue, because there, like in the third line or something, you say you're only reporting on the European view, and I would want to ask if there's like a difference between the European view and the international view on information problem solving, or is this just because it's only European authors?
Yeah, I did not really know what I write anymore, but probably, it was a special issue of in learning and instruction, I think, or in computers and human behavior. It were all authors from France, Norway, Germany. Then you get an idea about what is happening in Europe. So, but the things happening in the States and in Australia are in line with our work. But in that special issue, it were only people from Europe. That's the question. That's the answer on the question.
Okay, so thank you very much. And there's another question here.
I came closer so people can hear me. I want you to elaborate on the topic of bias that Christian and our room brought up. I found that very interesting. And I could imagine that at one point when you like have established all those strategies, and especially the strategy of I plan what I want to search for at the beginning, that you could at one point encounter the problem that Christian mentioned, that the people will then only look for one side of a problem and will not be open to be data driven anymore, because maybe we have to be data driven to a certain extent to not be too biased. And especially when you use Google, considering the fact that there's the problem that when you're like in favor of a certain topic and you search for that, Google remembers that and will in the future offer you more stuff that will confirm your view. And so it will be even harder then to encounter some information that challenges you. And I was wondering if you could say anything on that topic, on biasing of people, especially when they have that skill of being goal-driven and not being that data-driven anymore, and in combination with that Google problem that Google tends to show you what you were, what you're already in favor for.
Yes, that's really a nice a nice topic because, yeah, you are right. All kind of recommendation systems make that Google knows what you are searching for, and the next time you are searching for something, you get the information. Yeah, that Google thinks you are searching for. So yeah, that is yeah. Then your bias will be confirmed. What we did in our research was, and what is confirmed, is that people do have the tendency to select and search for that information that is aligned with their attitude. In this case, we also gave them the task, okay, you have to write an essay on a certain topic. We did not say anything about it has to be an argumentative text, or you have to make sure that you go into both sides of the story. But when you give an open task, what we see is that people have a tendency to search the information they want to search for. I don't know if you are more goal driven and define your questions in a better way, if that has an influence on the information you select, because the question is, how aware of are you of that you yeah that you are biased and that you are yeah performing in a certain way. For education, it is important that teachers are aware of what is happening here, because okay, knowing that we have recommendation systems, knowing that people are biased and searching for information that is in line with their attitude, I think for education it's important to really think about what kind of tasks do we students give. Do we give them those open tasks, or if you have the idea, I know, if you have the goal to let students search about a certain topic and go into the positive or negative sides of a certain argument, then I think you have to define your task and say to students, okay, you're going to write an essay on climate change, but make sure that you go into the arguments pro and contra, and make sure that you come up with a good conclusion. So then you trigger students to not only select biased information. So, but when you give only open tasks, then there is a possibility that they will be biased.
Hi. So I got a question about the premature closure idea you were talking about, and the confirmation bias that students have. So would you recommend any like prompts that foster metacognition about that topic? Like for example, it's somehow in the direction of the Kahneman research, that for example this five questions that you have to ask yourself five times during the process, like why did I select that argument, for example, or why did I search for that? Or is there anything you were already doing in your research about that, with the open questions?
I think it's because we all know that metacognition and reflection and regulating process is important. What we did in different research in which you also design instruction is to prompt metacognition is work with process worksheets in which you ask from students to what you say, answer questions on you did the next step, how did this went, what went well, how do you go on, so that you let students look back but also look forward, and try to stimulate metacognition and regulation in the process. So what you do is then give students kind of prompts in which you can say you have to reflect on your process. So what we also do in the study of Jimmy Frerian, who is going to start next week, we have three kind of prompts for reflection, prompts which we ask students to look for forward. So what is your next step? How are you going to proceed? But also kind of instructional prompts in which we say, okay, you have to select information, make sure that you use certain criteria. So who is the author? Who is the which is the organization behind the website, and so on. So different kind of prompts to make sure that students are more strategic in their process.
I'm sorry, I kind of lost some part of the discussion, but will you compare this group who received those prompts to another group who has no prompts and has no instruction?
What we will do is the group who get the prompts and the instruction, we will compare, because the instruction is built on the 4 CID principles, and we will compare that with a group who will get only supportive information. So they get a kind of a reader, a book about information problem solving, and maybe we let them do a few tasks, but we don't give the instruction with the prompts. So we will have a control group working on information problem solving, but in another way. What we did with the study of Jimmy on beforehand, because last year he did an experiment in which we compared different kinds of instructional measures. He used one condition with only completion problems, so that student had to were doing four tasks, and every task was built up. The first task was a whole worked out example, the second task a part of the process was a worked example, and then the other steps they had to do themselves. So completion problems compared to only prompting, compared to control condition, we had one with only worked example. So different conditions used to see, okay, what kind of instructional measure is best. But what we found is that all instructional measures, all conditions were equal, except for the control condition that was a flat line. So yeah, no idea what's working best, but that was an experiment in which we only gave students tasks for 2 hours, and the experiment he is setting up now is an embedded instruction in the classroom setting, so it will take 2 or 3 months. So it's another setting, so let's see what happens here. So that's that is about more instruction in what is working. Working with worked examples, prompts, completion problems, combinations of those principles. But in the first study of Jimmy, we saw that that they were all strong instructional measures. Frank.
So, I have two more questions, one more strategic and one more political to you towards the end, but I didn't want to interrupt that discussion. So if anyone, I think I interrupted Annelies before, if Annelies, if you would like to comment on the current discussion, or Maria or anyone, before I pose my more political questions.
It was interesting to follow the discussion, but I agree that we could organize a kind of sequel, because the question how to foster information problem solving or how to teach was less the focus of this this webinar. We more focused on the process and unraveling the process, so it would be nice to have like a kind of sequel to focus more on the fostering, how to fostering, prompting, scaffolding, information problem solving. But it was very interesting, thank you.
Okay, thanks Annelies. And then my two questions are, and the strategic and political, and you can answer one or both of them. So my strategic question is, what would you recommend to PhD students with respect to doing research or including aspects of research on information problem solving in their work? especially I became aware of problems if you include eye tracking, and because we made several attempts to do that with PhD candidates, it was not very easy, to say the least. But what would be your recommendations there? Technologies are developing quickly, methodologies are complex. What should a PhD student do? Is it reasonable to start including eye tracking, for example, if you are more or less on your own in eye tracking research in a work group? So this is question one with a couple of parts. And then question two is, as you are a professor of the learning sciences, I wanted to ask you if you see any specific aspects in your work in the learning sciences at the Open University or maybe in Europe, also as compared to other parts of the world. So is there one learning science, or are there several several quite different learning sciences, and what are interesting differences that students might want to become aware of?
Nice questions. The first question is about, okay, how do you proceed in your when you are a PhD and you want to study those kind of processes using eye tracking or not, if you are on your own? Because yes, I know it's a hell of a job, but yeah, here at the Open University we have a lot of experts in doing eye tracking studies, so that helps. But I think most important is when you are a PhD student is, yeah, not only for PhD students, what is your research question? Because your question is important, because yeah, the methods you use should be appropriate to come yeah, to find answers to your questions. And in my research think about when I think about eye movement, I always think you have to make a triangulation and use thinking aloud or cue to respective report, because it is partly a visual process, but it is not only visual, because there is a lot of cognitive aspects in it. We also did eye tracking studies with air traffic controllers, and this is really in visual expertise, because those people are looking to those screens with all those airplanes and have to make decisions about it. Okay, it's also cognitive, but it's far more, in my opinion, far more visual expertise. So I think you always have to make a kind of a combination between different methods, and yeah, sometimes it's not even not necessary to use eye tracking. So yeah. Important is what are your research questions, and do you really need eye tracking? So, yeah, that is important. Then the question about the learning sciences. When I look in what we do here at the Open University, for instance, in my research, but also the others, we do work together with people all over the world, also a lot of in Europe. But I think, yeah, we are in line with each other, so I don't know if you can say that there are completely different perspectives on learning sciences. I think, okay, there are differences in, how do you say, because of course you have all kind of topics in the learning sciences, and some are more from a psychology perspective, some are more from an educational perspective, so that makes it broad. But I think looking what is happening all over the world, I think we are quite in line with each other. So yeah, is that a bit of an answer? Somebody other ideas about it?
Well, yes, thank you very much. I think it's very good, very, very good and convincing answers from my perspective. So Saskia and everyone, I would like to come to close that session. I would really like to thank Saskia very much for her presentation and for stimulating a quite lively discussion. I think I learned a lot in that session, especially about the importance of evaluation of evidence. Also, when reading your papers beforehand, the importance of really investing time in defining what the problem really is, because that is what experts often are doing. I learned that it's not a good idea to put biased minds onto open problems, because they will only find what they were knowing before. So there was a lot, and I thank you very much for that. As Annelies already said, and Maria agreed upon, so we are very much looking forward to the sequel, to the next session that will be about instruction for information problem solving. Thanks, Saskia and everyone. So not sure if you might want to have the final word in that session.
Okay, yes, I'd like to thank everybody. Although we were with a small group, I think it was a nice discussion. And yeah, I really like to discuss also the instructional design principles. So let's see what we can do, Frank, to schedule another session. I always think these are nice sessions to discuss and to discuss together. So yes, I really liked it, and thank you very much. And Annelies, I think maybe we can have contact together, because I know we are doing quite the same kind of research. So that would be nice.
So thank you very much for the nice webinar here from Munich. We had a great discussion and enjoyed it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, also from our side, thank you very much for the interesting webinar, and thank you to LMU for the interesting discussion. And yeah, see you next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for the interesting discussion. And I would like to thank you, Ms. Growell, for the interesting information we received today. Have a nice day.
Hello, it was my first time joining a webinar, but it was a very interesting one, and I hope I can join other webinars in future. See you at another time. And Saskia, I agree, let's keep in touch. Bye-bye.